You're listening to the Jason Greger Show podcast, brought to you by Lakewood Chev. 0% financing for 84 months right now on the 2017 Chevrolet Silverado, plus up to 10 grand in price reduction. This may be the best deal on Silverados ever. Check it out, Lakewood Chev. Breaking story, top story of the day, brought to you by ProAmSports.ca. Get all your NFL jerseys, tees, headwear, signed and unsigned memorabilia today at ProAmSports.ca. And, of course, the big story in Canada right now is, and it doesn't really have a nickname. Maybe he doesn't need one, but people always like monikers. Maybe he's Dennis the Destroyer. Who knows? But our next guest has been following him around all season long. And, of course, a lot more interest in young Dennis Shapovalov after his big victory in the second round last night on main court, the Arthur Ashe court. The U.S. Open in the second round. He knocks off the number 8 seed, and now he moves on to the round of 32 as John Horn from TSN, who covers tennis for the TSN across the country. John, not only a convincing victory, straight sets last night for Dennis, but, you know, this is the second time now. It's not like it's just a one-off. He beat Rafael Nadal recently, and he looked very comfortable last night.
Yeah, thanks, Jason, for having me on. Appreciate it. It was phenomenal last night. The way that he played against Songa, I mean, you wouldn't have thought he was 18. You would have thought he was 28, the way that he was out there on court. Looked so confident, no nerves whatsoever. And he was just, you know, at times toying with Songa. I mean, Songa didn't play badly, but Shapovalov just played super well. I mean, only 19 errors in the match and 23 of 32 at the net. Was really strong with his volley game, something that wasn't so good at the Rogers Cup. Limited the double faults, which is, again, has been a problem for him of late. And when I say a problem, I mean, he's been winning. So it's just been adding to his, you know, another part of his repertoire that he can be stronger at and be even better. And I just thought that he played super well against a guy who's plays really well against left-handed players throughout his career, a guy who's got way more experience, way more Grand Slam experience. And it looked the other way around. It looked like Shapovalov was the guy who'd been in 12 years of Grand Slam tournaments, and Songa was one of the inexperienced guys. So I thought he played great. And to be on Ashe Stadium, prime time across the United States and the world, for everybody to see, this kid is the real deal. And I think everybody in New York is really taking note, and Shapovalov mania is hitting New York. There's no doubt about that.
Well, and it's a lot of fun for sure. And even the U.S. Open, sure, Songa's a top 8 seed, so that's part of it. But for a young player to get on Arthur Ashe court in only the second round, like, obviously if you're later on, well, then it's easy because there's very few matches. But for him to get on there this early just shows, I think, that even people in the tennis world are a little intrigued by him.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the Rogers Cup run, he played so well there, beating Nadal, beating Del Potro, winning. I mean, you could, even in the first round match on court 7, which isn't a huge court, standing room only, all seats were taken, standing room only to watch his first round match against Medvedev. The kid is well known now. People are realizing, and the tennis word is spread, and they're talking about this guy, and just the fact that he got onto Ashe for his second round match. Now he's going to play his third round match on Friday, and he's going to be back on Ashe Stadium again against Kyle Edmund. So it's it's one of those things where when anybody in the U.S. seems to get a grip on somebody, especially if it's one of their own, and in this case it's close to their own, but they haven't had a lot of success on the men's side and with American tennis players. So why not grab somebody who's a neighbor? Neighbor to the Americans and sort of pretend that he's their own as well. I think the Shapovalov is going to be adored by the New York crowd by the time this thing is all over. And when I say this thing is all over for him, I mean, if you look at the draw, he's got a pretty favorable draw. He plays Kyle Edmund on Friday. That's a match that I think he can win. The likelihood then in the fourth round, he plays Pablo Carreño Busta, the 12th seed. I think that's a player that's not an easy player to play, but I think he can win that. And then he'd be in the quarterfinals, believe it or not. And Marin Cilic is the guy who's sort of standing in the way. If he wins his matches and all goes to form the 5th seed, he's won the U.S. Open before. But there's no reason to think that he can't get past Cilic, too. So then we're talking semifinals. I mean, it sounds crazy, and you don't want to get too ahead of yourself and kid's 18 years old. Anything can happen. But the way he's playing right now and the role that he's on, if he just keeps it all together, there's no doubt that he could go deep. And I think he will be the big story of the tournament, you know, depending on whether or not Federer can get through and win it. But I think he'll definitely be one of the two big stories for sure.
I think the one thing that Canadians specifically need to, and even media people, I think, need to pump the brakes, because, you know, Jeannie Bouchard, she had a great year, and then people were anointing her like, you know, she's the next coming after one really good year, especially in majors. And, you know, and now all of a sudden it's like she's this disappointing player, because even though she's still one, you know, one of the best tennis players on the planet, she's just not somebody who's in the elite of the elite tennis players. And Shapovalov is a very young player. And do you think maybe Canadians and the media have learned to from that mistake? That, because I find like how people criticize Jeannie Bouchard, it's only because they put on unrealistic expectations just because of one good year.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, we're talking about expectations. There I am talking about the semifinals already. But yeah, I mean, I know what you're saying. And I think that, yeah, I mean, the expectations on her were high. But at the same time, it all came on very fast. I mean, she got to the semifinals of the Australian Open, and she'd won Junior Wimbledon before that. In this case, I think it's a little bit different in the fact that Shapovalov has been projected as a top player for, you know, 2-3 years now. I mean, there've been people talking about him, and Felix Auger-Aliassime, his good buddy, is even being better than Shapovalov. These guys have played junior doubles slams before. You know, they're good players, and people have been noticing them for quite some time. And are the expectations high? Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is not a country that produces, you know, a ton of great tennis players over the years, and there's been a lot of good tennis players. And with all due respect to Daniel Nestor, who probably goes down as one of the best doubles players of all time, maybe one of the best Canadian athletes of all time, but because he plays doubles, he doesn't get the recognition. And, you know, I think that any time that a country has a player, and this will go for any country who doesn't have a lot of athletes in a particular sport and then has a superstar, you sort of get on the bandwagon and you ride it. And I think media kind of goes along for the ride as well. Everybody wants to see Shapovalov do well. I think everybody, for the most part, wants to see Bouchard do well. It's just, you know, they're two different players and two different people. I think, you know, to me, at least when I watch Shapovalov, he's a lot more confident on the court. He's a lot more, he's got a lot of charisma. He hits the ball super hard. You know, Bouchard, I won't say that she didn't, but to me, she didn't have that same thing that Shapovalov has. So I think that, you know, there's a little bit more confidence in a guy who's been projected to be a star for a long time. And I think that he's really showing up on the big stages and doing very well. And I must say, the one other thing, Jason, I should tell you is that I think that incident that he had at the Davis Cup, where he unfortunately hit the umpire in the eye, and don't get me wrong, don't want to see that happen ever again. But I think that was a turning point for him. And I think, you know, maybe he's not even where he's at right now if that doesn't happen to him, because he had to grow up. A 17-year-old kid had to grow up and turn into an adult very quickly after that. He had to, you know, own what he did, and he did. He was super apologetic. He still texts and good friends with the umpire who he hit, checking up on him to see if he's doing okay. And then after that, he's you know, he's had to grow up, and he's, you know, been getting into tournaments, winning challengers, got to Wimbledon, went to Queen's Club, won a match there, had the run at the Ryder Cup. So maybe if that doesn't happen, maybe he doesn't grow up so fast, and maybe his game is different and he doesn't get to where he's at right now so quickly.
John Horn from TSN joins us. Now, if you look at his age, how would you compare him to a young Milos Raonic at his age? Obviously very different. You know, Raonic's serve was great, but a lot of the other parts of his game is the reason why he hasn't been able to, I think, consistently break into the top four. He just doesn't have the overall game like those guys do. How do you compare those two at 18?
Well, I mean, much different players. I mean, I think when Raonic, and he'll admit this, is that when he was 18, he had a serve and he didn't have much else. Not to take anything away from his game, but he's a lot fitter now, and I should say he's obviously injured now, so he's not fit right now. But just when he is healthy, he's moving around on the court more. He's got a more all-round game than he did when he was 18 years old. I think Shapovalov has an all-round game already as it is. I mean, he serves well. He's got a great forehand. He's got a great one-handed backhand, which we've seen already. I mean, some of the backhand shots defensively and offensively that he makes with that backhand. You know, when you watch Roger Federer play and how sweet it is to watch that backhand, and you watch Shapovalov do it. It's really beautiful to watch, and I think that he's got a lot of things in his arsenal. And if you factor in that, you know, his volley game is getting a little bit stronger, he's a confident player out there. He scrambles around, he moves well. I think that's something that Raonic didn't have. Raonic didn't have much of a volley game, if at all. He didn't move around the court as well. And, you know, I'm not sure he had the confidence that Shapovalov has. So I think those are the biggest differences.
So moving forward in this tournament, what do you make of the Federer? There's some talk about a potential injury for him. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's had this bad back, which he got in the final against Zverev at Montreal in the second set. His back sort of started acting up on him. He chose not to play Cincinnati. He was going to, then he chose not to. So he's had a bunch of rest. He's been saying that he's fine. You know, the big test for him was when he played that five-set match against Tiafoe the other night, that he, you know, let's see how he does in the recovery the next day. Is he tight when he wakes up in the morning? And he said there was no tightness at all. He felt good. And he's playing today, and he's destroying Yuzhny right now. So I think, you know, all concerns about the back at this point are off. You know, but this is a 36-year-old, double the age of Shapovalov, funnily enough. You know, after three or four matches, maybe a couple that go four setters, you know, that's going to be the telling point as to how does he hold up later in the tournament. And I think that there's no doubt to me that Federer, if he plays his game, can get to the semis against Nadal, if that's the case. You know, I wasn't convinced at the start of the tournament that Nadal would get to the final, but I really start thinking now that he can. And how about a Federer-Shapovalov final, Jason? What do you think about that?
Wow.
Let's really get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, hey, you know, anything can happen. We've seen, unseeded players go all the way to the finals of other events, so anything can happen. Now, speaking of unseeded players, even wildcard players, and Sharapova's, there seems to be a lot of negative feedback from the mm-hmm. She did her time. I don't think there's any debating that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's funny is the Melodonum used to be approved, then it wasn't. So, you know, we can have a debate over that, whether it's right or wrong. But what do you make of so much negative backlash towards someone because of that entire situation?
Well, it's tough. I mean, you're right. I mean, she did do her time, and she had her sentence actually reduced from 2 years to 15 months, so she actually got a lighter sentence. I think the biggest thing that you hear from a lot of the players, and when I was at Indian Wells earlier this year, you heard it a lot, was if she wasn't Maria Sharapova, would she have gotten the same treatment? And I think that's how a lot of the players are looking at it. If she was, you know, Susan Smith ranked 200 in the world and this happened, would she have got a reduced sentence? Would she have, you know, been getting the treatment that she's been getting from tournaments and getting wild cards and that sort of thing? That's the big question that I think a lot of players have problems with, because, you know, a lot of the players, you know, some like each other, some don't. But for the most part, just like the men's tour, all the players are equal. Most of them get along with each other. They're all part of the same fraternity in terms of the WTA or the ATP. And I think that, you know, they're kind of sticking up for the rest of the players on tour, saying, well, why does this person, granted she's a great player, she's won five Grand Slams, why is she getting preferential treatment? Why did she get a reduced sentence? Why does she get opportunities to get wild cards, which other players aren't getting because of the fact that she's getting them instead? You know, why is she getting on Arthur Ashe Stadium, you know, two matches in a row? I think it's pretty obvious for the first match, but, you know, some would debate why was she on Arthur Ashe for the second match. So I think there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, you know, there's a little bit of jealousy, but, you know, I think at the same time, you know, Maria Sharapova, unfortunately, is not one of the most liked players amongst her peers, and I think that also it doesn't bode well for her. There are a lot of players on tour who are good friends, who do get along, and they'll play each other in a tight match, and then they'll go for drinks or something. I wouldn't say drinks, but maybe they'll go for protein shakes after or something. But they hang out together too, and Sharapova is just not one of those players. She's very distant. She has her own circle, and I think that's part of it as well. So I'm sort of at the point now where I've never been a big Sharapova fan myself. I've sort of put her in the category of somebody who I just don't really see as a likable individual. You know, I think when she won the other night, she was genuinely happy and the tears were real, and I congratulate her for winning that match against Halep. But I think for the most part, a lot of players on tour feel the same way, just in the conversations that I've had and what some things have been said in the media, obviously from Bouchard. But you know what? she's done her time. You can't hold it against her. It's just like anybody else who has a situation where, you know, maybe they've done something wrong and they've got to come back, you know, learn from your mistakes and try to prove that you're better, a better person, you know, in the long run.
Now, looking at the, you know, Raonic, you know, injuries over many years have plagued him, sadly, right? And he's that big, long body. And, you know, I've been reading some who wonder if, you know, injuries are slowly starting to break him down. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, and again, he'll admit this is the biggest hurdle that he has in his career is staying healthy. And he just has not been able to stay healthy for long periods of time. And it's unfortunate when the body lets you down like that through no fault of your own. It's not as if he's doing anything on the court. You know, I use golf references every once in a while, too, because I cover some golf for some years. But, you know, you look at Tiger Woods and the trouble he's had with his back. The golf experts will tell you, and you can even see just watching him, the way he swung his golf club, you know, the amount of torque that he used to put on his back. I'm not surprised that he's got back issues, to be honest. But when you watch Milos Raonic play, there's nothing there that sort of makes you go, yeah, that guy's probably going to be injured. He just plays the game as best he can, and he just has unfortunate injuries. I think, you know, I heard somebody bring up a few weeks ago the fact that Raonic grew very fast, very early, and very young. And I think that plays a contributing factor. And I've heard that a couple times now where athletes, whether they're hockey players, basketball players, are more prone to injuries if they grow at a young age and they grow fast. So that happened to Raonic, and maybe that's something that's coming back to haunt him now, because a lot of the injuries, not so much the one that he has now, which is a wrist injury, but some of the other injuries had, which are sort of adductor injuries or groin injuries, those are the sort of things that could be affected by that. So I think that, you know, he's got a full team. He's got a full-time physio trainer, and he's one of the students of the game. He analyzes it. He breaks it down. He has a group of people around him who are trying to get him fit, and he's doing the best he possibly can. I just think it's kind of like the Peter Forsberg of hockey. He's a walking hospital. He can't do anything about it, and it's unfortunate because I'd like to see him win a Grand Slam. I think it's still possible. I'm sort of, you know, thinking it might be harder than it ever has been now, just with the way the game is going. But I'd still like him to win a slam, because he does have a game and he has been working on it for a while. And I think it's unfortunate that he's had all these injuries. It's too bad that we're always, whenever we're talking about him, it's the injury word comes up in every equation, even when he gets to a final or he's lost a match, won a tournament. It's, can he stay healthy? How long will he stay healthy for? And it's just too bad.
It is disappointing. Quickly looking at the draw, you talked about Shapovalov's draw, and you like it, all things considered. Now, he still has to go out and win. But the way he played last night, now, Zonga's first serve, he really struggled. I think it was only like 51% on his first serve. And in tennis, you know, that's a horrible number, and it's really good for, you know, for your opponent. Mm-hmm. What you saw from him last night and what you've seen in him in Montreal recently, where is he making these improvements where suddenly he's now beaten two of the top 10 players in the world in the last few weeks?
Well, I think it's just a matter of cutting down on the errors, to be honest. I think that's the biggest thing, is that he just needs to keep the ball in the court. Look, he's a player who plays for broke a lot. He doesn't, you know, he's not, to me, he's not so much a tactical player in that he sticks around for long rallies. He goes for shots. He looks for openings quickly and he tries to nail them. And, you know, the reason why you'll see him shank a bunch of balls or you'll see him, you know, miss some shots is because he's going for it. And I think, you know, that's one thing that in the match with Tsonga last night, he only had 19 unforced errors, 28 winners, but he was going for it and the ball was going in. And I think, you know, he's got to be careful with that. I think that, you know, because he plays that kind of style, I think it's the go for broke style can work against certain players, but it can't work against other players. And, you know, when he played Nadal, he was playing lights out at times. And, you know, Nadal is just got the speed and he just knows how to play so many good players that he was able to get balls back. And, you know, if the opponents can't get balls back, then he's good. But when he plays the faster players or the more tactical players, that's where there could be some problems. I think he's also got to, you know, keep consistent with his serve, keep his first serve percentage up. I think that that's important. Limit the double faults, which he did yesterday, and I think he'll be good. And Caledon's a good player. I mean, he's got a good forehand. He's a young player as well. He's 42 in the world. He's had a couple semifinals this year, but he hasn't had really much in the majors at all this year. So I think it should be a good match tomorrow. And I mean, if I were to handicap it, I'd say Shapovalov's the favorite just based on what he's doing. But I don't think you can take Edmund lightly. So looking forward to seeing what happens. And we'll see if he can get to the fourth round, which would be remarkable. He'd be right up there as one of the youngest to get to a Grand Slam fourth round for men. And you got to remember, he's also played three rounds of qualifying.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Too. So I mean, it's pretty remarkable what he's been able to do. So El Chapo, Dennis the Menace, whatever you want to call him. I've got this word, this nickname going for his entourage or his people that want to watch him, the Shapoholics. I think it'll be great to see him win another match and get into the fourth round if he can do it.
Well, it'll be huge. Now, do you know what court he's playing on the next one? And does it, like, outside of the size of the crowd, is there any advantage players talk about? Do they, like, they all want to play there just because of the crowd, but is there anything other than that that's different from playing on the Arthur Ashe court?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's going to be playing on Arthur Ashe again tomorrow. He's okay. The second match up, so no sooner than 1 o'clock. It could go a little later depending on the women's match. There's a Kvitova Garcia match that's going on right before that, which starts at 11. So you predict it's going to be somewhere in the 1 o'clock Eastern range for that start time, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock for you guys. But yeah, I mean, it's a different experience. I mean, it's just. You know, you got the music's louder, the scoreboards are going, the stadium is gigantic. You can hear people talking. That's one of the things the players have been talking about, especially when the roof is closed. You can hear people talking when you're on the court. The echo, the sound traveling down is a lot different, whereas when you're in these smaller courts, the sound travels up and it's more wide open. You can't hear people as much. So if there is a little bit of rustling going on higher up, you can't hear it. But at this court, you can. So that's the main issue. But look, if you're focused, I don't see any issues with that. Federer says he likes it, Nadal says he hates it. Shapovalov sort of seemed to think he was indifferent with it. I mentioned last night after the match about a couple of drunk guys, hanging out in the crowd and yelling at him just for fun and trying to be buddies with him, which I thought was kind of funny. So I don't see that being a problem. And, you know, the fact that he's already had one match on Ashe Stadium and Edmund hasn't, I think that bodes well as well. That's an advantage.
John, enjoy the tournament. I've been to the U.S. Open, one of the best sporting events I've ever been to. What's their featured drink this year? Because they've had different ones at times. Do you know what it is?
I'm not a drinker, Jason.
Oh, okay.
I'm strictly a worker, so
I would never know.
Yeah. I would be, water. The water is fine, so honestly, I haven't looked into it.
Okay.
But we'll maybe next time for our next week, we'll report back with some.
Yeah, let's get into the real serious
things.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no, some of the guys. I'm sure there's been a lot of people who've gone there, and the experience is phenomenal, and it's definitely one that everybody should take in. It's a bucket list item for sure. I think. Even if you're not a big tennis fan, it's definitely something that you have to go check out. Make sure you bring your wallet though, because it's not
cheap.
Yeah. Oh, the grounds passes are pretty good.
Yes.
They're only like 60, 65 bucks. But if you want to go out for dinner or stay at a hotel, make sure you bring the Brinks truck with you.
Oh yeah, it's a tad expensive in New York. But how humid is it there right now?
It's not too bad.
Okay.
It's a pretty. I don't know what humid is in Edmonton so much, but it's not too, it's bearable. There's some sweat running down the arms and the back, but it's not too bad. It's usually the hustling between courts that's usually the biggest thing. When something's going on 17 and you got to hustle back to center court and then get to court 5 and then get to the press room, and the problems that you have as a media guy, it's big issues here.
Yeah. Thanks for your time, John. We'll talk to you next week.
Jason, enjoyed it. We'll talk soon. Thanks.
John Horn from TSN covering the U.S. Open.